From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project, it's an opportunity for us to join you with thinking about media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, hoping that my colleagues and I can bring you analysis and commentary and perhaps even some insight into those issues. Dr. Alan Chartok is, of course, here, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Thank you for being our host, Alan.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure to have you here. And when you get here on time, I even like you more.
Well, that's very kind. So we can just speak slowly this time because we have plenty of time to record the show. Ira Fussfeld is here, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Nice to see you all.
All right. And Judy Patrick is here of the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady prior to that.
Always glad to be here and talk about media issues, which they just keep on coming, don't
they? They just keep on coming. That's right. So David says, you'll keep the Media Project. Please spend time on the barring of a CNN reporter for an event at the White House. I may be paranoid, but I find this ominous. We will talk about that momentarily. We have someone who writes in from George in Connecticut. I think the topic you all brought up at the end of the show of presenting news for mobile merits more discussion, especially on the subject of clickbait. And the horrible things that come into one's Google News feed, obviously written by complete amateurs for the sole purpose of selling advertising, and what you can do as reputable news organizations and what we can do as consumers to fight this scourge. Wow. That's called programmatic advertising. That's the term of art in the business. This is stuff that is sold, that appears automatically on websites. There's actually an instantaneous bidding process that's handled by computers to place this sort of advertising stories that are written with a particular advertiser in mind. And it is really terrible stuff. It's just, you know, trashy. You'll never believe what this model looks like now, right? The problem is it brings in a lot of revenue. And so,
and they always have something down there, Rexy, that I don't understand. And you guys are so much smarter and you'll explain it to me, where it says sponsored stories.
Yeah.
And so
yes.
The first comes the so-called news. And then right below it, as you go to each page, it says sponsored stories. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. Sponsored stories. That's a euphemism for, boy, this is garbage.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it may come under the definition of native advertising. It may come into the definition of advertorial. But it's advertising that is presented and looks like news. And the advertisers are not mad if the readers believe it is news.
I think this is something every news site is struggling with now. You're seeing some of the major news organizations trying to set a standard where they will have some sponsored content, but they won't let the advertiser actually control what's happening, or they will go to an advertiser and say, hey, we're going to do a story about the Himalayas. North Face, would you like to sponsor this? It's a very, I think editors think this is a very distasteful dance we have to do.
Yeah, it is.
But the question of clickbait is interesting because the writer suggests something new about it. And what is new about it is the format, the digital format, and measuring readership in the number of clicks you get. But that's not unlike selling newspapers. The newspaper or the site wants people to read what they're putting up, and so they're generating stories that will be clickbait. Now, the question is the clickbait in the Times Union going to be the same as the clickbait in the New York Post? And the answer is probably not.
The difficulty of this is one of the downsides of this stuff is that it makes your site load more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And slow loading is one of the key factors leading to abandonment. People will walk away rather than waiting for a site to load, and they'll click off to another site. We're very impatient. We've gotten accustomed to instantaneous response on the web. And so you really have to weigh the revenue that you bring in with this programmatic advertising, this native content, whatever you want to call it, against the loss of value to readers in the slow loading or the possible abandonment of your site altogether.
So how do you do that, Rex?
I don't. Fortunately, there are experts. There are people who are really digital experts who look at the numbers of that and calculate what value it has. And we argue all the time. I would say that our executive producer and I are constantly pushing people at the who kind of run the digital operations for the Hearst newspapers. And we say, get this stuff off our site. This is not. And they say, well, yeah, we don't like it either, but we have to get a certain amount of revenue to sustain the operation.
And isn't it interesting that you have a position at your newspaper called executive producer, a title that has been historically broadcast, and that suggests what? Well, you explain it. Why executive producer?
That's a very important person in our newsroom. I feel as though I share the leadership of the newsroom with her.
And, well, why is it not a title more traditional?
Because what they do is more like what TV people have historically done. They're producing, right? Yeah. What did you call it at the Gazette?
We called it, we had a digital director.
Uh-huh.
And then we had web editors. We hadn't gone to producers yet.
Yeah. But did they report to you, Judy? Or,
yes,
they did.
Yes.
And in your case, Rex, is
not
it
exactly. It's a dotted line because we're not just a single independent newspaper the way the Gazette is. We have these, Hearst now has 30-some newspapers, but five major papers. So we have a team in New York, a digital team, who pays a lot of attention to this stuff with analytics and all this data and stuff, and it's a significant job.
You know, in the old Soviet Union, they would put a commissar in each unit of the army. So you'd have the captain who was running the unit, and you would have the commissar who really was
well,
the guy who
said it's civilian access to the military, don't you think? That's nice.
No,
innocence.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to make sense of all of this.
Yeah.
That, you know, you have to remember who to be nice to because maybe the bosses want that person there.
Yeah. I'm actually very grateful that there's somebody who knows a lot more than I do about the digital stuff who is there right in our newsroom every day. And this person, by the way, our executive producer, actually came from the newsroom. She was one of our great copy editors before she went to the digital side about 10 years ago and started doing stuff and rose to the leadership.
So are there algorithms in which
they
know, you know, as you posited before, that there was some tension between, you know, how long it took to load and that. So they know what fits in. Is that right?
Yes, and the data actually shows. But some of it is open to analysis. You know, we want to drive digital subscriptions. We want people who are abandoning the print and just looking at our digital product to subscribe to the digital product. So you try to make it as attractive as you can to have a big funnel, as they say, to draw people in and then convince them to subscribe. And you don't convince people to subscribe if it's not what they want or if it's hard for them to load. Or there are a lot of variables.
And what you're seeing is an erosion also of visits to the homepage and less of a focus on clicks and more of an focus on how long they're looking at the story. So what newspapers are doing, like on mobile apps, people will go to them because there's less of those distractions, those banner ads, the sponsored content. And it's something newspapers are trying to figure out how to deliver their content to readers in a way that will keep them returning to the content.
And not tick them off. So, for example, Rex's newspaper does one thing that annoys me just a little bit. It is not that bad. But, you know, if I am a subscriber to the newspaper and I get my Times Union online every day, I'm delighted. You know, it says click here for the newspaper, then you get it, each of the pages is terrific. But then they also send out these other things that are designed to get you to look at them.
Newsletters?
I don't know what you call it, but big stories of the day. So I'll get my Times Union, but I'll also get, you know, these six stories are important. And if you click on any of those six stories, they say, would you like to pay $1 to get the to get the thing? Don't you see what the problem is here, that I'm already a subscriber, but they don't know that when you send out that.
That's
teaser.
Actually a malfunction.
Yeah,
that
surprises me. Your email address should be registered to subscribe.
We can fix that for you.
I appreciate that.
Sorry about that.
I appreciate that very much.
But one of the things that Rex's newspaper does, has succeeded in doing, if you believe it's a success, and I think it is from a business standpoint, is that if you see a story, say, on Twitter or on Facebook, that's a Times Union story, and you click through the story, you will get that message. You want to read the story, you got to pay for it. I think most newspapers, or at least perhaps it's a decreasing number, that's been a way to get around the paywall. You can Google your way into the site without paying, and you've succeeded in blocking that.
We have a dynamic paywall, which means that certain people will get that at a certain time. Some people will probably get 8 stories a month before they hit that. There are certain kinds of stories that never fall behind the paywall. If you're somebody who just looks at photo galleries, you know, the social events where people are all looking very pretty, and a lot of people love that stuff, you'll never hit the paywall. But if you're going for journalism that costs us money to produce, you'll hit it more quickly.
Well, that's interesting. Judy, I wanted to ask you a question because, you know, you're this now senior advisor, vice president, poobah, in charge of helping out these weekly newspapers, right?
Correct. And dailies, some dailies.
And some dailies. Yep. I see. So do weekly newspapers have the same digital issues that dailies do?
Exactly. And when we talk about New York State's weekly newspapers, there's a whole range of them from this, you know, the small town weeklies to some of the bigger ones on Long Island. They are having the same issues. They don't want to give away their content to free. They're trying to monetize it. They know that the digital advertising hasn't reached the point where it can sustain the journalism yet. So they are dealing with the exact same issues. There's just more of them.
Are their sites fresh each day? In other words, do weeklies becoming daily on digital?
That is something that they are doing as well. Some of them are still on a weekly mode. They will post their content on a weekly basis. Some of them know that, you know, the news happens all the time. Mm-hmm. If they want to be a site where people come back to day after day, they have to be fresh. But as we all know, running a digital site takes a lot of manpower. And the weeklies have the same manpower issues that the dailies. You know.
Or worse, there may be one person running the whole show.
Which
is one of the reasons why what happened at the New York Daily News is so interesting, because they've cut so many people, but their game plan apparently is to be a digital product primarily, if not solely. Yet, as Judy says, you need a lot of people to produce the digital site, and now there's far less of them at that property.
The New York Daily News, in case you all missed the news, went from a newsroom of perhaps 85 to half that number, with additional layoffs, perhaps dozens more in the back shop, let's say, other positions, perhaps 90 positions overall cut from the Daily News. The Daily News, which once had a daily circulation of 4 million, is down to perhaps 200,000 in print. We don't know what their digital imprint is, but it has done important journalism for many years. It's an institution in the city of New York, and suddenly there's this decimated newsroom, half the size of my newsroom in Albany, and you simply cannot cover the city of New York with a team that size. Nobody from the Daily News is in the press box to cover the Yankees or the Mets.
So what's the outlook then, Rex?
I think it's just terrible. I don't see how they can survive. It's this terrible ownership trunk, the remainder of what used to be the Tribune Company, which originally founded the Daily News, trunk now based in Chicago, just paid out, by the way, $15 million to their CEO, who retired after he failed with his effort to lead the company forward. A $15 million payout to this guy named Michael Farrow, who has retired. And somebody calculated that you could have paid the entire Daily News staff for perhaps 3 years. With what he got when his
on the other hand, they would drum me out of the publishers, retired publishers club, if I didn't at least raise this devil's advocate question. This is a property that's losing upwards of $20+ million a year. Mm-hmm. How much longer can you expect an owner, whether it's privately or corporately, to swallow that?
Well, they got the wrong owner, obviously. I mean, the Washington Post goes and gets the Bezos from Amazon, and who's the richest man in the world, and it becomes something. Why couldn't they have found, and the Berkshire Eagle goes around and finds some people who have a great deal of money?
Yeah, and I would make the argument they're selling 200,000 subscriptions. I don't think the newsroom staff's payroll is so exorbitant that it can't sustain on the revenue produced by 200,000 subscriptions. From my mind, I'd love 200,000 subscriptions.
which, of course, raises the question, why Trunk buy it in the first place? I mean, in other words, why are you buying a failing product? That do you really think that if you move it to a digital basis that it's going to make this a profit center?
Well, they bought it because they bought it for a dollar, literally a dollar.
Well, not quite,
from Mort Zuckerman.
I take great exception
to
that.
That's with a reported price.
No, they bought it for a dollar, but they had to assume all the debt.
The answer to your question is, as is the case with many other corporations that have bought properties at a time when you wouldn't think you'd want to buy newspapers, is they believe that through efficiencies, combining the business offices, combining the editorial departments from around the chain, there are other large newspapers in this chain, that they will save enough money to start perhaps turning the corner. I go back to our original premise, which is, I don't know how you can cover your community and thus sell digital or print subscriptions if you don't have as much as you used to have. But that's a question that all of us in the business are wrestling with. There are very few, if any, newsrooms today, perhaps Washington being the exception, that has more people in it than they did 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Or the Berkshire Eagle. The vaunted Berkshire.
Which way have they gone?
Well, they have more people.
They have more people.
Yeah. With local ownership. Yeah. And I don't know. I presume they're making money. I have no idea.
Well, I'm always presuming everybody makes a little money, at least a little money. But, you know, they decided they were going to turn that paper around, and they've done everything in their power.
Or take losses to offset gains elsewhere and benefit from the tax.
When the cost of your newsprint, which is their second most expensive line item, is upwards of 30% more expensive than it used to be as a result of the tariffs.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. The tariffs are about to be made permanent, and
well, we don't really know. As we speak today, he's tariffs yes, tariffs no.
Well, with Europe, but this is a specific Canadian tariff with a Canadian wood processor.
And what makes you think that in the end he doesn't reverse himself there as he reverses himself everywhere else?
Because I think it's too small for him to pay attention. Right. He doesn't get the big headline. He doesn't get to stand in the spotlight and shine and make himself look like a big guy.
Well, you know, politicians, Rex, have a very interesting relationship with newspapers. I remember, and so do you, that when Rupert Murdoch bought the Post or was buying the Post and it looked like it might go under, Mario Cuomo, who was the subject of an awful lot of negative articles in the New York Post, because it was a right-wing institution, stepped forward to save it. Mm-hmm. And now we see the Sun taking a page, Andrew Cuomo taking a page out of that same book, saying it's terrible what's happened to the Daily News.
And why didn't you come to me, he says. We could have helped. I don't know how he could have helped. I don't know. How could he have helped? It's a difficult notion. But, you know, the problem is now you look at Trunk's other newspapers, Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun, Orlando Sentinel, Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel. What are they going to do? They brought in, as editor and publisher, this guy from Allentown, PA, who spent most of his career in San Diego. So a guy from Allentown, Pennsylvania, is going to be the editor and publisher of The Voice of New York. I can't picture how that's going to work.
Well, I've always liked the name Allentown.
Spelled differently.
That's right. They misspell it in Pennsylvania. Terribly sorry. Anyway, we're at WAMC. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith. Next to me here is Judy Patrick, Ira Fussfeld, and Alan Shartok down at the far end of the table.
Far left end of the table.
Practically out of the studio. He's so far down there. What can you do? Anyway, we promised that we would talk about... by the way, we should just say a word that one of the good things about what has happened with the Daily News is that Ken Lovett, the fine Albany bureau chief, remains here. He's one of the terrific reporters in the Capitol, and the layoffs, while it took out his colleague Glenn Blaine, it did spare Ken Lovett, and we're really grateful for that.
The most puzzling part of that layoff for me is the tabloids have historically been attractive to sports fans, sports readers, and 34-person department, sports department, is now 9.
Yeah.
And that's
really
troubling.
Idiotic.
Yeah.
Anyway, we promised we would talk about what happened at the White House. One of the readers wrote in to say, what's this? The White House has barred CNN reporter Caitlin Collins and what was called a spray, that is, in which there's a photo op with the president and reporters try to ask questions.
Yell questions.
Yeah, this has always been something that's happened forever.
And sometimes Trump answers them and sometimes he doesn't.
Absolutely.
And this goes back a number of years. As long ago as I can remember is Reagan. I don't remember if it predates Reagan, but Sam Donaldson yelling at Reagan.
Exactly. So Caitlin Collins of CNN was there as the pool reporter. That is, she was representing all the major television networks so that they don't all have to send in their reporters. They get one camera, one reporter. So she asked Mr. Trump several times if he was concerned about the loyalty of Michael Cohen, his former personal lawyer. That's who the president had tweeted about that morning, so it was relevant, using his official government Twitter account to make a comment. She was following up on that. She said, did Michael Cohen betray you, Mr. President? And then, Mr. President, are you worried about what Michael Cohen is about to say to the prosecutors? And he did not reply. And after that, she was barred for inappropriate questions.
And all hell broke loose. Everybody checked in. All of the major journalism organizations checked in. Even Fox said this was wrong. Because there, but for the grace of God, goes us.
Because once they did once under the Obama administration, there was an effort to ban a Fox News reporter from an event. I mean, it's not unheard of for a governmental entity to try to ban a reporter. I can remember at one point the Utica mayor was trying to ban the reporters from City Hall. But it's not right, and it has this chilling effect because access is something the reporters need. They need to be able to do their job, and if they are barred. And in this case, this woman was the pool reporter. She was representing the entire press.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's face it, these spray pools and the kinds of questioning that occurs makes the media look bad, even though they're only doing their jobs. The people at home are watching these people scream at the president and try to get his attention.
They're rude.
Right. They think they're rude. What I'm looking to see what happens, and it may have already happened by the time this airs, is that the White House Correspondents Association, in complaining about this action, says, "We will not let this stand." Well, what does that mean? What are they going to do? Are they going to recommend to all their members not to come into a press conference? Are they going to do civil disobedience and sit on the floor in the Oval Office?
And it's also kind of stupid, right? Because CNN is going to send somebody else to the press conference.
Well, but I don't know, because I think, as we point out, given Fox's reaction, it could happen to any of them. And so they don't want this to stand, but I don't know how they can prevent it.
Well, it's only one time, I think. In other words, they said, you're not welcome at the next one. So a little slap on the handlet.
And we should note that it's been over a year since the president had a press conference. The reporters in Washington haven't really been able to ask a series of sustained questions of him in a very long time.
Right, because you know why? Because he's chicken. Because he's so weak that he can't handle questions from the media. Because he doesn't have the capacity that every president before him since Dwight Eisenhower has had, which is to stand up in front of television cameras and take questions straightforward. He can't handle it. And the problem, too, is that you have a president who claims that Russia, quote, is all a big hoax, which is, again, going back and forth. He's of course, going back on this notion that the investigation, which he has now said, yes, Russia interfered with the 2016 election, but now then he goes back a day later and says, no, it's all a big hoax. And so attempting as a reporter to cover an administration where the posture is continually changing based upon the president's tweets is virtually impossible. It's very difficult for the reporters, I think.
You know, you were saying...
I'm sorry.
Okay.
When Melania was caught, her television was caught playing CNN on the air, and the president went apparently into a rage that the only televisions that would be permitted were going to be the Fox people.
Right. He's raging against reality, really, is what he's doing, because CNN is reporting what's going on, and now his staff increasingly keeps him isolated in a bubble where he only gets the feedback loop from Fox, which, of course, airs primarily, not entirely. There are a couple of decent journalists at Fox, but I don't know how you atone for a career working for Fox News. Maybe you go off and... sign up for a big PR firm somewhere.
Wait, St. Peter's going to look at you on your way down and say, you work for Fox.
You know, I understand if he wants to watch Fox News, but can't Melania watch whatever channel she darn well wants to?
Apparently not. This old man has been divorced many times.
Apparently not. By the way, a listener also sent us a message saying how much he appreciated Barbara Lombardo being here last week, a former editor of the Saratogian, whose son, David Lombardo, used to work for Judy and I works for me down at the Capitol.
Great guy, great reporter.
How about that? And finally, Anderson Cooper was criticized, says a reader, for expressing what the panelists identified as opinion. Walter Cronkite, the most respected American at the time, the dean of television journalism, returned from Vietnam and expressed his strong opinion.
Yep.
Cronkite's views had a strong and important effect on our country's opinion. I watch Cronkite and Cooper. Cooper is not Cronkite. However, trusted journalists who have covered this world should, under the Cronkite rule, be able to tell us when a journalist and impartial observer sees a major transgression. So thanks very much from listener Steve on that. And we're out of time.
Oh, boy.
So for Judy Patrick, Ira Fussfeld, and Alan Shartok, I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us on The Media Project.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained
Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.